Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. Good to have you all with us. We are about to take a look at what's going on in Syria and then switch to Iran after the top of the hour. And we are joined by Michael Curtis, distinguished professor emeritus of political science at Rutgers University, contributor to theamericanthinker.com, James Paul, author of Syria Unmasked. And until recently, Paul was executive director of Global Policy Forum, a think tank that monitors the UN, and Omar Hosino, independent researcher who focuses on Syria, visited Syria recently and writes about the Syrian conflict for Syria Deeply, Foreign Policy, and many other outlets. And gentlemen, welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, nice to be with you.
So we are at a cusp of what could be a major entanglement and involvement in Syria. And I think there have been a lot of people who are saying because of the sarin gas being used, that this demands a response from the West, from the United States. And, of course, you saw President Bill Clinton say that that President Barack Obama better do something like I did in Serbia or he'll be mocked in the future. This is something he needs to do. On the other hand, there's a complexity to Syria where it's not so easy to parse out good guys, bad guys. A lot of secular forces around and many diverse forces who support Assad. There are liberation people and Democrats who oppose him but are worried about how al-Qaeda and Hezbollah have moved into this. So this situation, Michael Curtis, is much more fraught with difficulty than simply saying we're going to create a no-fly zone and give money to the rebels.
Well, you're right. It's an enormously complex problem. And what we had was a war that began as a series of demonstrations against the regime, which was fraught with problems, but which then developed into a brutal civil war and a sectarian conflict between the different Islamic religions, the Shiites and the Sunnis. But the problem now and the difficulty has become both a regional and an international problem. With very curious combinations of countries and groups taking the sides. Now, you mentioned the sarin, the chemical weapons. Now, that's only a small part of the problem because the problem is much much wider and more problematic than now. Now you have a lineup on the one side of countries like Saudi Arabia and Turkey and Qatar and Jordan that are opposed to the Assad regime and understand the danger it poses. On the other hand, you have this rather curious combination of countries like Iran and Russia, Hezbollah, possibly China, one doesn't know about that, which are supporting the regime. And the United States has to take account of this. Now, you're absolutely right that there's no easy answer to this problem because there are bad guys on all sides. On the one hand, you have this brutal regime, which is morally indefensible regime. It's a morally disgusting regime. But nevertheless, it had an element of stability about it. The real problem, the fundamental problem, why I would reject supporting the Assad regime, is that it's a tool now in the service of Iran. And Iran may well be the most dangerous power there is with its attempt to introduce nuclear weapons in the regime and use missiles and chemicals against other people.
Well, maybe in French, you can bring James Paul in and then Omar Hosino. James Paul, how do you see this complexity in terms of what it says about U.S. policy?
You're asking me again?
James Paul.
Yeah, in the first place, should the United States be providing very substantial aid to rebel groups that are dominated by Islamic fundamentalists? I mean, is this a good policy? Doesn't it smell a bit like training and arming Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan several decades ago? And this really, and the idea that there's just two forces available, and they're both bad guys, but there's our bad guys and the other guy's bad guys. I'm sorry, there's quite a substantial nonviolent democratic movement in Syria. that is current, and also the United Nations, through its special envoy, Mokhtar Brahimi, are trying to reach a negotiated settlement here. And the United States is not supporting that idea. And simply providing arms based on a very dubious claims about chemical weapons use is just not the way to go. These claims, by the way, were rejected by the UN investigators on the ground, who said that there's inadequate evidence and that a lot of the available evidence points to use by the rebels. But in any event, this chemical weapons business is very, very small. Whatever the claims are, it's not a large part of the picture. And so, therefore, to start adding weapons to the Al-Qaeda people is an extremely bad policy.
So, I wouldn't agree entirely with that. Of course, the problem is that the rebels do include a lot of guys we would call really, really bad guys, Islamic fundamentalists, members of the Muslim Brotherhood, members of the Syrian Islamic Front. But there's only one group that's an Al-Qaeda-linked group, the so-called Jabhat al-Obra, which has about 6,000 people out of the whole. It's true that that group is fast-growing and so on, but it is only a small part. Now, this is not to say that one can make a deal with them, but at least I think it's a recognition that the rebels are a mixed lot. The number of secularists is unfortunately apparently rather small, but nevertheless, it's the group that ought to be encouraged and to which we support. I certainly would argue that it's desirable in American interest to provide help, certainly not send troops there, but to do a number of things. One is to see that there is a no-fly zone, and therefore to stop the Syrian and the Assad forces bombing the rebels. I think we should insist that Iraq stop Iranian air shipments to Syria and provide some anti-aircraft weapons, and above all, to stop S-300 air defense missiles going to Syria and to Hezbollah.
But let me ask you this question, though, sir. I mean, but what would that mean? So the United States gets involved in that, so that puts us on one side?
No, the United States is not involved at all, not direct with troops by forces, but by sending some form of arms and preventing, I mean, the no-fly zone is preventing the Assad regime from slaughtering more of its own people.
But
after all, the chemical weapons only killed 100 to 150, undesirable and horrible though that is. We're talking about 93,000 so far that have been slaughtered. And even the weakest form of humanitarian assistance ought to realize that this is an impossible situation and has to be stopped. Where is the humanitarian outcry against this abominable behavior?
But it seems to me that there are abominations on all sides here.
There's no question.
And there are
no good guys. But this is what international politics is often about. There are no really good guys, but you have to take what is the least undesirable option. And what I'm suggesting is that the preventing of Assad bombing his own people by a no-fly zone and by preventing the shipment of these Russian-made, these very important S-300 air defense missiles.
But that doesn't that then, James Paul, but that puts us in the conflict. Then we're in it.
Well, not really, but neutrality is not an option. You can't just stay back and try and appease things. This failed in 38 and 39 to prevent the rise of...
But that's also what happened. So we've got involved in Iraq. Now we're going to get involved in Syria. So we're going to have the United States going to be in the middle of another...
Well, we're not being involved in the war, I
was trying to get James Paul back in.
I'm suggesting the least possible intervention,
right,
which would be helpful. Now,
Michael Curtis, I'm trying to get James Paul back in the conversation.
I'm glad to get back in the conversation. And and the other guest was minimizing the importance of the Jabhat al-Nusra affiliated with Al-Qaeda, and forgetting the fact that the Western powers made sure that the dominant force within the umbrella group is the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Muslim Brotherhood represents another huge segment of this, of the rebels. So I'm sorry, there's armed fighters that are coming from Saudi Arabia, that are coming from Afghanistan, that are coming from all over into Syria to fight on the side of the rebels, and the U.S. knows this very well. So this is, just really pouring gasoline on the fire. And as far as no-fly zones being some kind of innocent thing that protects civilians, I'm sorry, no-fly zones, we have lots of experience with that. We had experience of 10 years in Iraq. It was an extremely dangerous program there. And in particular, we saw it in Libya. And what happened with the no-fly zone in Libya? As soon as they got the planes in the air, they started attacking Libyan army. They started attacking. It wasn't just some innocent flights over certain parts of the country and so on to deliver humanitarian assistance.
Gentlemen, I have to interrupt because we have to take a break because we have to take a station break right here. And we're going to come back and let you finish your thoughts and bring Stephen Zunis in to this part of the conversation as well. Just a few more minutes as we talk about Syria before we move into Iran. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're going to take a couple more minutes here on Syria, then move into Iran. And we're also joined here by Dr. Stephen Zunis, who, of course, is Professor of Political International Studies and Chair of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco, Senior Policy Analyst with Foreign Policy in Focus. And we are continuing with our other two guests for the next couple of minutes. James Paul, author of Syria Unmasked. Until recently, he was executive director of the Global Policy Forum, a think tank that monitors the UN. Michael Curtis remains with us, distinguished professor emeritus of political science at Rutgers University and contributor to AmericanThink.com. But let's take a couple more minutes with all of our guests here before we turn to Stephen Zunis completely to talk about Iran. And Stephen, let me just let you jump in real fast about your analysis of what America's response should be in Syria at the moment.
I think the fact that the majority of Iranians voted to elect a relative moderate in such massive numbers, the regime wasn't able to steal it this time, is indicative that there is interest in better relations in the West, with the West. I think it's important that the Obama administration, come forward with the making clear they do want better relations. This is not inherent hostility towards the country. The hardliners in Iran have been able to milk the strong sense of nationalism among ordinary Iranians to their benefit. And I hope the United States does not make the same mistake they did under Qasemi, the previous moderate president, by rejecting the overtures. Indeed, it was that very rejection that led to, in part, to the election of Ahmadinejad. So I think really do need to try to press forward for a better relation.
But before we jump deep into Iran, which we're going to do in just a minute, I wanted to kind of conclude this conversation about Syria so we can talk about Iran for about 10 minutes or so. And with the guests who are here to talk about Syria. And the question I have for all three of you, just very quickly, has the United States kind of lost whatever influence it has because we've taken Assad. We said Assad has to go. I mean that the role we could have played in negotiations we've completely lost. So what role can we really play with any authority? And I want really quick responses because we do have to move on. I'll start with Michael Curtis, James Paul, and end up with Stephen Zunis. Michael.
Yes, and I would still argue that there is a role for the United States to play. It's not one of military intervention, but there are a number of things which I've mentioned previously, which the no-fly zone is one, and of course the S-300 air defense missiles are another. But just to realize what we are doing now, the CIA is in fact training some of the rebels, giving help. It is supplying arms that are going through Jordan, so that we as a nation are not involved with any military resources other than what is being used by other people. We're helping Turkey, which is, of course, also threatened by Syria, and there's been exchange of gunfire between the countries. And so that the United States is playing a role. It's also trying to persuade Russia to change its position. Russia, you know, has simply refused to believe that chemical weapons have been used in spite of all the objective evidence. But it's argued. Now, there is a conference which is actually taking place as we speak today in Northern Ireland of the major powers, and one hopes that the American Secretary Kerry will have some input then in trying to persuade the Russians to change their position, to stop supporting the Assad regime.
So, I'm sorry. So,
opportunities for diplomatic relations. Egypt, realize, has now been brought into the equation. Egypt has broken diplomatic relations with Syria and closed its embassy there. So it's not simply the United States which is involved. It's a whole part of the world which is objecting to what the Assad regime has been doing.
So, James Paul?
Yeah, well, I think in the first place, the issue is primarily about oil and about the U.S. policy to control the Middle East oil, and that's the overarching issue always in U.S. policy in the Middle East. I think secondly, U.S. had a very aggressive posture towards Syria and towards promoting the rebels, and the U.S. hasn't been interested in seeing a negotiated settlement and been working with various allies in order to pursue this war and to overthrow by military force the government, no matter what the future may be. So I think it's not a question of U.S. influence somehow being thrown away here. U.S. is pursuing a very, very nasty policy in Syria, and that's the problem. That's why we're not getting a negotiated settlement. That's why the U.N. Special Envoy, Lakhdar Brahimi, doesn't have the support he needs to go to Geneva. That's why the Russians, even though they've been fairly accommodating, haven't been able to make any headway, and that's why the nonviolent, democratic, pluralistic opposition in Syria is not being given really any support as they need.
I'm going to thank both James Paul and Michael Curtis for being with us. Thank you so much for taking the time. It's been great to have you on the air with us. We look forward to having you on again soon. And let me turn now to Stephen Zunis. Stephen, you want a final thought on Syria before we leap into...
Are we now?
Pardon?
We're leaving, are we?
Yes.
Yes, thank you. Okay.
Hi, Stephen.
I don't think it's unreasonable, given the massacres and brutal oppression against nonviolent protesters back in 2011, to call for a process, a negotiated process, that would lead to a change from Assad's rule to a democratic government that would represent all Syrians. But I think when you start sending arms to rebels, including those that have include some pretty extremist elements, you're just adding fuel to the fire, and then you really do lose any credibility in terms of playing a constructive role. The so-called Free Syrian Army is not just one unit. It is literally hundreds and hundreds of separate militia, some of which have engaged in atrocities themselves, certainly not on the level of the regime, but they're the kind of a people that you cannot trust to have a particularly democratic post-Assad future. So I think really the role the United States could do is try to to defuse the conflict, try to discourage the armed resistance, and try to help those who within civil society that to rebuild the nonviolent resistance movement for those who actually want a real democracy in the country instead of this existential power struggle between two extremes.
So let's leap over to Iran here, Stephen, and continue that conversation we started earlier in the program. This, in some ways, this election is very interesting to me because some people are calling it the freest election they've had in Iran in a long time, in terms of the vote, not in terms of who they allowed to run and not allowed to run in this election. But it also kind of shows a surge of not just students in the urban areas, but also labor that have come together to say we need a different country internally, because they're pretty much in sync on leave us alone about our nuclear capabilities and what we want to do. But in terms of internal Iranian politics, this is a significant election.
Yeah, yes, it is. I mean, yeah, the president is a fairly weak figure constitutionally.
Very weak, right.
Especially in foreign affairs, but he can make a difference domestically. Even if he's able to open up things just a crack, my hope is that civil society can use that crack to push the door open even more, because the Iranian people are really tired of the status quo internally. I mean, many are willing to rally around a flag in the face of threats from the West. The vast majority of Iranians are angered at the hypocritical policy, the double standards of the West in terms of targeting Iran's so far civilian nuclear program while allowing Israel and Pakistan and India to develop nuclear weapons, also in violation of UN Security Council resolution. So there's a fair amount of unity there, but domestically certainly there is a real demand for change to break the grip of these reactionary clerics that have been holding the country back in so many ways for so long.
So I don't know how you think this will play out, because I think it doesn't seem like it will have an effect on what the Western world is so involved with in terms of what Iran is doing or not doing with its nuclear reactor. But what it says about the entire Middle East region and how this might affect it, this election, even though in some ways it is symbolic because this is a weak post. It says a lot about where the Iranian people are.
A lot of people forget that the strong system of nationalism Iranians have. I mean, they are literally, and this has been demonstrated by empirical studies, are those nationalistic people in the world. And there are these hardline elements that were deliberately provocative, not just on the nuclear issue, but on other issues involving the region, that seemed almost designed to get people mad at Iran so they can say, oh, you got to support us because we're being threatened by these various outside forces, and we are standing up for these righteous things, and the world is against us, and you know, taking advantage of that, as a lot of autocratic and sometimes less autocratic regimes have done. So I think it's important that that the international community try to and take advantage of this clear desire for a more for dialogue, for a more open international policy. And because what we've seen historically since the revolution is the more Iran feels threatened, the more they can get away with crackdowns at home. And the less Iran feels threatened, the more reform and push for reforms we can see both within the regime but also from the outside.
But this particular election will not have, as we close here, not have that much effect on Iran's foreign policy at all, really. This is really has some...
Well, I think the biggest effect it might have, frankly, is that Ahmadinejad, in many ways, was the kind of Middle East leaders Americans love to hate, you know, in the tradition of Gaddafi and Saddam and that kind of thing.
Right.
I mean, he was just a poster boy for the extremists and the hawks who really wanted to push for war with Iraq. And I think the best impact this will have in terms of foreign policy is that having a more, a less extreme, bombastic character in that kind of public position will make it harder for the hawks on this side of the Atlantic to push for confrontation.
Well, Dr. Stephen Zunis, it's always great to have you on. I love your analysis. It's always a pleasure to have you be part of this conversation. We'll be linking to your books and to the other work you're doing. He's professor of politics and international studies and chair of the Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco and senior policy analyst for Foreign Policy and Focus, and a presence on the show. Thank you so much, Stephen.
Pleasure.
We're going to take a brief break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Dave Zirin, sports correspondent for The Nation, sports editor for The Nation, and his most recent book is Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down, and Milton Kent, professor in the School of Global Journalism at Morgan State University, freelance writer, former sports columnist, and more. Stay with us. We'll be right back.